Welcome to the Animals Radio Show here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, January 30th, 2015. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Cynthia Ganatra.
Hello.
Our guest co-host, Farah Nazarali.
Hello there.
And our control room tech trainee, Amir Ali.
Hi.
Alyssa is away today. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for stepping in today, Farah. It's good to have you back.
Thanks.
Animal Voices is Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living, broadcasting live every Friday from noon till 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and bringing you interviews, commentary, news, and events that you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and abroad. In addition to our live broadcast here on 100.5 FM and at coopradio.org, our shows are also available as podcasts and on iTunes and at animalvoices.org after airing. On this week's show, we have two interviews for you that concern animal rights issues that we have seen in the news recently. The first is the BC Wolf Call. As you may already know, earlier this month, the British Columbia government announced their plan to activate their strategy to conserve a dwindling caribou population in the South Peace and South Selkirk regions of our province by killing up to 184 wolves in the next 2 months by shooting them from helicopters. The execution of these wolves is already happening now, and many conservationists are outraged by this action and say that killing one species is never an answer for saving another. Ian McAllister will be here with us today from the nonprofit wildlife conservation group Pacific Wild to explain the situation to us more. And for our feature interview, we'll be discussing the issue of foie gras for the first time in depth on the show. In light of the recent overturn of a California state law that banned the selling of the fatty duck liver product known as a food delicacy to many, we'll have Liz Hallinan on the show to give us the details about how foie gras is produced and what went into the passing and then striking down of the law that had banned the sale of the inherently cruel product in 2004, much to the victory of animal activists and the ducks. Liz is the Director of Public Policy of the U.S. National Animal Advocacy Organization, Compassion Over Killing, and she will also be telling us about an interesting lawsuit that COK currently has against the USDA, where the USDA is being called out for violating its own law in allowing the production and consumption of a diseased organ in the U.S. That interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned.
So earlier this week, Chipotle, which is a fast food Mexican-style restaurant in the States, and we have a few locations here in Canada, had a promotion offering a free vegan burrito with the purchase of another burrito. So you buy a burrito, and then you get another burrito, a vegan burrito, at a later date. So some of you may know Chipotle from the nationwide campaign against them by DXE, Direct Action Everywhere, who has been protesting Chipotle for their campaigns, which involve a lot of humane washing. So Chipotle likes to say that they ethically raise their animals and kill them humanely. But of course, we have, as animal rights activists, know that there is no humane way to kill someone who does not want to die. So it was pretty interesting to see that many vegan animal rights organizations and individuals were heavily promoting Chipotle this week and praising them for their vegan option. I personally found it a bit strange that there was so much support for Chipotle when oftentimes we don't see support for groups like Direct Action Everywhere and their campaigns against Chipotle, yet more people are quick to support these large corporations that kill millions and millions of animals per year. So there was some debate on Facebook, a few people posting about the burritos and a few people posting kind of some post against it. So, so personally for me, I earlier was talking and I kind of said, well, if it was like a fur farm or a group that sold fur coats and they had a vegan coat, would we be promoting the corporation in the same way? Probably not. And so I think
definitely not.
Definitely not. Yeah, exactly. So I think it's interesting when so much time and effort goes to promoting these corporations that kill millions and millions of animals. Of course, I think having vegan options is great. I'm a vegan. I need to eat, and it's good to know where I can eat. And I also think there should have been perhaps some acknowledgement that why is Chipotle having this free vegan burrito? Perhaps it's pressure from these direct action campaigns. So,
or because of, you mean?
Yeah,
the campaigns aren't saying, can you please offer some vegan burritos, and we'll leave you alone.
Yeah, that's no, but happening. It's just to kind of say that, hey, look, more ways of Chipotle saying, hey, look, we're doing good things for vegans. So,
And it's not that those steps of having vegan options is the ultimate goal, because it's not the ultimate goal. It's a step in the right direction, but the ultimate goal is to end animal cruelty altogether. So I think it's too much effort is being put in those steps that really should be put in towards something that's aimed towards the ultimate goal.
Yeah, and I totally agree. I think that we should, you know, be happy when these steps happen, but we should see where we're putting our energy and our effort. And I also think there needs to be more solidarity in the movement. We need to support groups that are doing work as opposed to supporting the corporations.
So what would you say is the difference between this campaign? It's a restaurant chain that serves a lot of meat, like many of them do, and they're offering a vegan option, which is great. So what's the difference between that and, say, our local restaurant down the street that serves lots of meat and, say, they're offering a vegan menu now? So where do you draw the line between promoting and not promoting that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like, I personally don't promote restaurants that serve animals. If they had a vegan menu, like Panago came out with a vegan option, it's great. I think it's wonderful. Panago's doing their own promotion for it. I don't need to promote it on my Facebook. I eat Panago pizza. It's a great option for me. But if I spend my time, I'm more promoting education on animal issues as opposed to food. That's just my personal thing. But I also think Chipotle uses this humane washing where they tell their customers that they're doing a favor by buying their products because their animals were killed humanely, which, like I said earlier, we know there's no humane way to kill an animal or anybody who doesn't want to die.
That's what personally gets to me, is I do find it insulting that they are actually telling these lies. And I know, you know, I've protested against that before, whereas sort of I feel like the restaurant down the street that has some vegan options now, or even Panago that now has vegan day of cheese, they're not saying that they're treating their animals great and they're living great lives until they get killed and slaughtered. And that's sort of a personal thing for me. They're both doing the same thing, but they're like selling the same kinds of products, vegan and non-vegan, but I find that it's really insulting to me to know when Chipotle is actually spreading these lies. And as you said before, they're playing on people's compassion.
Roots Reggae, heard every Friday night from midnight until daylight. 7 hours long and 7 hours strong. Giving you music for the mind, soul, and body. It's an holistic experience. We say it's ital and vital. My name is Lyndon V, and you've got it locked in Vancouver's healing station, 100.5 FM CFRO.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio, on unceded Coast Salish territories. So now in events, Direct Action Everywhere is having demos this week at Whole Foods and other locations across the world. They've been having demos every week for the month of January to expose the fraud of free-range eggs after an undercover video by the group was released from a Whole Foods supplier. There's protests here in Vancouver. So for more information about the protests in Vancouver, you can look up Direct Action Everywhere, Vancouver Coast Salish Territories, or you can look under the Direct Action Everywhere main page to find a protest in your area. Animal Freedom will be hosting a chicken vigil on Sunday, February 1st, between 1 and 3 p.m. in Surrey. It will be held at Sunrise Poultry Processing on 73A Avenue and King George Boulevard. For more information on this event, you can contact Donna at animalfreedombc@hotmail.com. The ADAV Society and Stop UBC Animal Research is presenting the award-winning film Maximum Tolerated Dose at Eternal Abundance on Wednesday, February 4th at 8 p.m. Eternal Abundance is located in Vancouver at 1025 Commercial Street. Tickets are $5 at the door, and no one is turned away for lack of funds. And there'll also be a special Q&A after with the director. And for those who don't know, Maximum Tolerated Dose is an award-winning full-length documentary that looks into modern-day animal experimentation. And then from UBC, the Jewish Students Association of UBC is hosting a screening of Cowspiracy on February 5th at 5 p.m. at the Hillel Building at UBC, which is located at 6145 Student Union Boulevard. The screening is in part of celebration of the Jewish New Year of Trees, and so the group is promoting sustainability by showing Cowspiracy, which I think is great that it's being shown at UBC. And then also we have upcoming events coming up, which Farah is going to tell us about.
Oh yeah, I'm so excited about this event. I look forward to it every year. It's such a great way to celebrate Valentine's Day and such a non-traditional, conventional way to celebrate an event really that's designed to open up our hearts. And why not open up our hearts in a way that shares the fact that we can express our love for all beings and everything that we do and all the choices we make. So Drishti Point Radio and Animal Voices come together. We produce a series of events. It's a vegan bake sale that's this year on February 12th, a film screening that's on February 13th, and a yoga workshop that's on Saturday, February 14th, just on Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm. And so the film that we're screening...
Oh, it's a good one. It's called Confessions of an Eco-Terrorist. Some of you may be familiar with Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd Society. And this is not the same film as Eco-Pirates. It's a different one. And it's a fantastic film about the efforts that they make to protect marine animals and vulnerable animals.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And then our bake sale, which is on Thursday, is going to Hearts on Noses. Some of the funds raised will be going to Hearts on Noses. So there'll be lots of delicious treats, and that'll be at Unity Yoga. And so you can find more information about these events on our Facebook page or our website.
Mm-hmm. And the bake sale, there's going to be so many delicious chocolate goodies, cupcakes, chocolate truffles, Nanaimo bars, all sorts of delicious sweet treats. So we're really
cupcakes.
Looking forward to that.
You're making cupcakes. I'm making cupcakes too.
Yeah, last year, there never can be enough cupcakes.
No, everybody loves the cupcakes. And last year it was such a success. Everybody really enjoyed, the whole three-part series. So I'm also looking forward to it. Again, this is our third year already?
It's the third year, and every year it gets bigger and better. And it's this year I'm really excited because I have a feeling there will be a much larger yoga contingent in terms of yoga teachers who come to see the film screening. And what's really nice about that is the purpose of these events is really designed to bridge the yoga and animal advocacy communities around the whole principle of ahimsa, which is non-harm. And it's actually the ultimate aim of the yogic path and the purpose of the path, so we can start discussions about what it means to enact ahimsa in our lives.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And then just a quick to let you know, also on Friday, February 13th in the daytime is the World Love for Dolphins Day. So it's an event held by Sea Shepherd, and that'll be in front of the Japanese consulate from 12 to 1 p.m. And they're happening all over the world. So you can look, contact World Love for Dolphins at seashepherd.org to find out an event near you. And so that's in honor of the dolphins that are killed in Taiji. So if you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to share on the show, please email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for the events. For our first interview today, we have Ian McAllister. He is not only a wildlife photographer, but the conservation director of the nonprofit organization Pacific Wild, which is dedicated to defending wildlife and their habitat by developing and implementing solution-based conservation strategies. We reported on the show earlier this month that the British Columbia government has just launched a wolf kill program, which involves shooting up to 184 wolves from helicopters as a method of population population control to save endangered caribou in the province. But Ian says that the wolves are not responsible for the dwindling population and that implementing such a kill is ethically, scientifically, and socially unjustified. He is here today to provide a voice for the voiceless and to give us some perspective on what is happening right now for BC's wolves in what is being called by wildlife advocates as an ill-conceived plan. Hello, Ian, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show. Thanks for coming on the show today to talk about the wolf call that the BC government is currently implementing in the South Selkirk and South Peace regions of the province. I want our listeners to get a good background of where this decision to cull or kill is coming from. Our government says the wolves need to be killed to save our endangered caribou population. Can you talk to us about what the situation is for the caribou right now and why their numbers are so low?
You know, the province in their recent media releases seem to think that this is, or at least they're trying to put the message out there, that this is a sudden and an immediate issue. It's something that just came up and drastic measures need to be taken, such as this wolf cull. But in reality, this is something that has been going on for over four decades. There has been exhaustive work and studies done on caribou recovery over many years, and during each one of these lengthy research and consultation periods, we know that even the province recognizes that habitat destruction is a leading cause to the decline of woodland caribou, and it's not just one single form of habitat destruction, but there's many things, unfortunately, that face caribou and have put them in the decline that we see today. There's, certainly clear-cut logging and road building has allowed access to wilderness areas that caribou rely on, and there's mining issues and oil and gas issues and many other industries, including recreational vehicles, and this is one of the principal threats to the remnant herds that are found today is that deep snow was traditionally one of the main security measures that caribou benefited from, because wolves just don't do as well in deep snow. But every time a snowmobile or a cat ski operation penetrates into caribou habitat, it allows for easy access for wolves. And we also see the changing predator-prey dynamics in these areas that have been heavily fragmented. Clear-cut logging often offers a short-term benefit to ungulates like moose and deer, and this, of course, increases the wolf population. And then when those ungulate herds suffer a decline, then wolves are switching their prey base to caribou. So, these are all man- and human-caused issues, and unfortunately, instead of dealing with those issues over the years, the BC government has turned a blind eye, allowed industry to continue impacting caribou habitat, and today they're really using wolves as a scapegoat to deflect scrutiny on their negligence in protecting adequate levels of caribou habitat over the years.
And I've read that there's only 18 caribou left at this time as of last March.
Yeah, some of these herds are almost biologically extinct. They are just hanging on by a thread. And, many people think that given the provincial government's refusal to address habitat concerns, that they really are the walking dead and they don't stand a chance. And so the question is, are we justified in killing hundreds and hundreds of wolves throughout the interior of British Columbia to protect caribou that don't have a chance because their habitat hasn't been protected? And I think this is the issue that a lot of people are really contemplating and questioning.
So given the scientific evidence of the real reason for the dwindling caribou numbers, can you shed some light, as far as you know, as to what went into the decision of going in this direction to kill wolves in order to address the problem? You're talking about the government choosing the wolves to be the scapegoats, but there must have been some kind of, you would think, some kind of scientific process that went into this, I would hope. What do you have to say to that?
Well, there has been a great deal of science focused on this issue, and if, for any of your listeners that would like to do further research, there is lengthy peer-reviewed research papers showing that habitat destruction is the principal reason for the decline, and so that is what the science is pointed towards. In terms of this stopgap measure, this wolf cull that has just been announced, it's really because the provincial government has refused to address all of those industries and to curtail human encroachment and critical habitat. And wildlife management planners and right to the premier's office is saying that they would rather continue industrializing caribou habitat. And they would rather kill wolves and hope that saves a few remnant herds. And all evidence shows that this won't work. It's been tried before. Hundreds and hundreds of wolves have been killed in order to enhance ungulate populations in different parts of the province, and it just clearly hasn't worked. And we don't expect this to be any different.
Yeah, so I want to know more about that. As far as I know, the wolves are already being shot from helicopters and they're being killed now. Can you tell us more about how this is being implemented and more about what it means for both the wolves and the caribou?
Yeah, it's really difficult to get information on a daily basis right now. It's almost like a state secret, this widespread killing of wolves. What we do know, though, is that the packs of wolves that the provincial government had radio collared a year ago have been killed in the Selkirks, and those are the first wolves that they went after. And it's really disturbing because, again, taxpayer funded projects that put these radio collars on the wolves are now being used to, in fact, track them to the rest of the pack, where they're being killed by helicopters with semi-automatic rifles. And so, the government actually calls them Judas wolves because these poor wolves that have the collar around their neck are giving up the rest of the pack, the rest of their extended family, to these aerial hunters. And now these helicopters have moved to the north in the Peace area, and they're continuing the killing up there. And we've filed Freedom of Information requests trying to get information on how many wolves are killed and where and when, but of course we're not getting any response from the provincial government about this. I really think that they had hoped that this issue would have gone unnoticed and wouldn't have stirred up the kind of really international outrage that is being directed at the BC government right now.
I've read as well that this is really an inhumane method of even killing the wolves, because many of them are left injured and suffering, not even killed right away. Is that true?
Oh, well, you can imagine. This is winter time, so the snow is deep. So these helicopters are tracking the wolves with these radio collars, and they're being shot at from, a helicopter in deep snow. Of course, these wolves are running for their lives. And, British Columbia's, Canada's own animal cruelty laws state clearly that if an animal is to be killed, whether domestic or non-domestic, that it has to be killed at close range and has to be shot in the brain and has to be immediately inspected if it's wounded or not. So these wolves that are being killed right now are more than not being wounded, and there's no way that these helicopters can land in most of the terrain because of the deep snow and the wooded environment. So most of them are probably being left wounded, and yeah, it's just it's completely inhumane way to kill a highly social, highly intelligent animal, one that relies on its extended family for its survival, and I think it's, you know, in the natural world, it's one of the more grotesque acts that humans could commit.
And what do you think the government should be doing instead to protect the caribou, instead of killing these wolves so inhumanely? What else could they be doing? What could they be doing instead?
Oh, there's so many things that could be done. And you know, of course, there's quite a bit of ecosystem diversity in British Columbia, so there's going to be different actions that could be taken to protect different herds. But we know that some of the most endangered herds are... that it's recreational activity. It's the huge growth in snowmobiles and cat skiing and recreational vehicles that are penetrating into critical caribou habitat, which is allowing for these unnatural transportation systems for wolves. And so that's something that, you know, could be stopped immediately. But instead, you know, the snowmobile lobby and MLAs like Bill Bennett and others are allowing this to continue.
Now, we know that Pacific Wild is conducting an aggressive campaign to stop the wolf cull in BC and that you've gathered a lot of signatures. Can you tell us a little bit what the feedback has been from the public and from people? And do you think that the public outcry can really make a difference?
Yeah, the response has been truly remarkable. You know, I think of over the last 20-plus years of wildlife conservation work in this province, I don't think I've ever seen an issue that has generated such widespread, not just within British Columbia, but abroad, outrage and condemnation. We have just literally been flooded with phone calls and emails, and, you know, over 140,000 people have signed the petition and just about a week's time, and we ran a crowdfunding campaign to pay for some ads and other wolf campaign work, and we reached the goal in 5 days. And there are thousands of letters that have been written to the province, and it continues to be a very big story, not just in Canada, but internationally. So I think that is probably the most inspiring part of this. But on the other hand, we have so few regulations and environmental laws that, you know, it limits us in terms of what we can do and for legal action against the government or, you know, anything else. They really have this incredible cavalier attitude about our wildlife. This provincial Liberal government is a staunch supporter of trophy hunting and trapping and poisoning and so many other inhumane commitments that are happening to our wildlife, and this wolf kill is really, I think, nothing more than an extension of British Columbia's wildlife management policies, which in many respects would see the end of wildlife in large parts of British Columbia.
Well, I know you do have this petition that last time I checked it had over 136,000 signatures. Can you tell our listeners how they can act to sign that petition? Will that help, do you think? And what else can people do at this time to help stop the wolf cull?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the most important thing. You know, if people are concerned about how wildlife is being managed and if they want to ensure that killing one species to protect another species doesn't become institutionalized in our wildlife management policies in this province, then this is the issue that we have to stop. It just cannot continue. So we strongly support people to go to our website, pacificwild.org, to sign the petition that we have there, to visit our social media pages to keep updated, to support us financially so that we can take this to Victoria and Vancouver, where these decisions are made, so that we can keep advertising this issue, we can keep it in the media, we can get people out on the front lines to document this issue firsthand. There's a lot of ways that people can get engaged in this, and that information is all on our website. So I hope that people are motivated, because the more outrage and the more attention this gets, the better, hopefully, it will be for the wolves that are still alive and still out there.
Well, thank you, Ian, for coming on the show today to give us more details about the wolf kill currently happening in British Columbia. To find out more about this issue and what you can do to help, as Ian said, please visit Pacific Wild's website at pacificwild.org. Thanks for all the work you're doing, Ian. Have a great day.
Okay, thanks for having me.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I'm Farah Nasrallah, and I'm here to tell you a little bit about news around the world. In France, very exciting news, a foie gras producer has appeared in court because they're accused of serious animal cruelty in a case which campaigners are determined to turn the trial not only into a case against animal cruelty, but also to bring a spotlight on the controversial delicacy. France produces 74% of the world's foie gras and has around 8,000 producers. And they produce many of the world-famous chefs. For example, the multi-starred chef Joël Robuchon and Britain's famous chef Gordon Ramsay. So it's this producer that has produced foie gras for those chefs that's on trial. It's the first time that a producer of foie gras is on trial. And in particular, animal rights advocates are really trying to turn the spotlight on the practice of gavage, which is injecting food directly into the guts of ducks. So according to an animal association, L214, there's only one way to produce foie gras, and it comes at the cost of severe suffering to the animal. Even on the tables of the most prestigious restaurants, foie gras is nothing more than the distressed liver of a bird trapped in a cage, stuffed and sickened. And if they are convicted, they will face a fine of 30,000 euros as well as a prison sentence. So this is really something to keep an eye on and see what precedent it sets and how it changes the whole industry and perception of this delicacy.
And we'll be learning more about what is called this food delicacy in about 3 minutes or so with our feature interview.
That's right, which is really exciting that we can go a little more depth into what foie gras is. Another news event is that GoDaddy, which is an internet domain company, recently pulled a puppy ad from the air that was supposed to air on Super Bowl Sunday. And more than 40,000 people signed an online petition asking them to remove the ad, which they did. Change.org said GoDaddy is encouraging private breeding puppy mills while shelter animals wait patiently for their homes or worse to be euthanized. So luckily it was a victory that they did pull the ad, and we really need to be vigilant around these issues because there's so many myths and so many campaigns that really perpetuate cruel practices towards animals.
What is it with GoDaddy? You're probably aware of the scandal a couple of years ago when its owner was found killing, it was an elephant, right? And I think it was, or you don't remember that? Mm-hmm. That was actually big in the news a few years ago, and it was pretty sick. He had, I can't remember which wild animal it was. I think it was a beautiful elephant, and he was saying, yeah, it was, and it was in Africa, and he was proudly posing on a photo and saying that he was helping with the population of too many elephants, and as you know, elephants are endangered, and a lot of people pulled their memberships with using GoDaddy as a host, so
I think it's
bad.
It's just an example of how embedded the myth of killing is in our society, how
You're
acceptable
right.
it is, you know, that it's like some sign of your power or something, and it's really the opposite. It's really so cruel to take advantage of vulnerability.
I'm really glad that people too were cognizant enough to speak up for dogs. They're not being I guess the backstory is dogs are being killed when you're not saving them from shelters. That's where they're being killed.
Right, and really when you're talking about purchasing animals on the internet, they can be used for anything, and many may be used for very cruel things. So last thing is a victory that PETA won a victory in pressuring IKEA to adding vegan meatballs to their menu, and IKEA was thinking of adding vegetarian meatballs, but they recently decided to add vegan meatballs. So this is a great thing for people who might like to go to IKEA and shop there and have lunch while they're there.
They have like a 99-cent meal or something like that, I think.
Yeah, I think it's right. Well, I mean, I've never been there because there's nothing to eat before.
So. Well, I've walked past it once or twice before, but yeah, I think they had 99-cent pancakes or something, but of course, but yay.
Yeah, so that's a great thing, a step in the right direction. Yeah. Of course, ultimately, let's remember that it would be great if all food was just vegan by default and all killing was outlawed.
In a perfect world. Thanks so much for the news, Farah. That was great. Our feature interview today is with Liz Hellinan, who is the Director of Public Policy for the U.S. National Animal Advocacy Organization, Compassion Over Killing. As you may have heard earlier this month, a federal court struck down the California law that had banned the sale of foie gras, that is the diseased fatty liver of ducks, in the state for the past 2.5 years. Restaurants in California are now able to serve this item for consumption despite its inherent cruelty that got it banned in the first place. And COK was and still is active in campaigning against the production and sale of what is known a delicacy in the food world to many. Liz is here today to speak to us about the cruelties of foie gras and how Compassion Over Killing has played a role in trying to get the production of this product made illegal in the U.S. Hello, Liz, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Hi. So to start, for our listeners who may not be very well versed in the food product of foie gras, can you explain for us what it is and how it is produced?
Sure. So foie gras is known as an expensive delicacy. It's usually served in very fancy restaurants. And it's essentially a liver from a goose or a duck that has a particularly high percentage of fat in it. So this is to distinguish it from other livers, say a chicken liver that goes into a pate. It's actually defined by the percentage of fat in the liver. In fact, the word foie gras is French for fatty liver. In the U.S., it's made primarily from ducks, but geese are used in other countries. In the U.S., it's primarily served hot. A piece of the liver is seared and served hot. But in European countries, it's also sold cold as a pate or a terrine. In addition to it being famous for its high price, it's also infamous for the inherent cruelty that's involved in actually producing the product. So the way it's produced is geese or ducks are force-fed a large amount of a carbohydrate, usually kind of a corn mush, and this is to induce their bodies to deposit that large amount of fat in their livers. The force feeding is done in a particularly cruel way. What happens is a farmer will shove a long tube down the throat of the duck, forcing the food directly into the stomach. It's sort of churned and forced down into the bird. This happens about 2 to 3 times per day, and it can go on for 2 to 4 weeks before the duck is slaughtered. To give you a sense of how much food we're talking about, if we were to do this to a human, we would be feeding them 45 pounds of pasta a day.
That's a lot of pasta. Wow. Compassion Over Killing has been one of the animal advocacy organizations that has conducted undercover investigations on the production of foie gras to see firsthand how it's produced and the inherent cruelties involved. Can you tell us about the discoveries that have been seen in these investigations and just how the animals are affected by, for example, having these pipes put down their throats?
Yeah, great question. So I saw you guys posted our undercover investigation of a farm in North America, in New York State, actually. And it should be noted that video was actually taken on a pre-scheduled tour. So this is what it looks like when the farmer or the facility opens up their doors and lets people come in. This is what they think of as being acceptable behavior that people can view for themselves. So in addition to what you might think, what you might imagine we would see on this tour, it's exactly as awful as it sounds. So we were seeing birds grabbed by their necks or by their wings and sort of forced between the legs of a person who then shoves that pipe down their throat. You know, they'd like to talk about how the birds don't mind it, but you can see in the video that the birds are, you know, shying away from the feeder, desperately trying to get away from being force-fed. In addition, there are all sorts of things we see that are a result of having that much food in them and becoming as heavy as they do. Their livers, by the end of the feeding process, grow to 10 times the size that they would otherwise grow. So what happens is we've had people report that these birds become so heavy they find it hard to walk. So we've seen them struggling to try to get to water that's in their pens. Some people have reported that the ducks have been so desperate to get to the water that they actually use their wings to propel themselves along the ground because they can't walk to the water themselves. In addition, we know from necropsies of birds that have come off these farms that they suffer all sorts of internal problems. So they have internal wounds from the pipes going down their throats and being forced to consume so much food. In general, the most common thing is, of course, they all suffer from a kind of liver disease known as hepatic lipidosis. This is basically, the definition of the disease is having too much fat in your liver, which is exactly the point of this production process. And so in a human, if a human had this from obesity or other complicating factors, we would call that a disease. And so basically every animal on this farm, on these farms, are in fact suffering from a disease that we've induced in them from this feeding.
Wow, that's horrible. The process of creating foie gras is deemed to be so cruel to animals worldwide that some nations have completely banned its production. What countries are these, as far as you know, and what have been the processes taken in to initiate these bans?
Yeah, great question. So there's actually quite a long list. The list I have in front of me includes Norway, Poland, Sweden, Switzerland, Argentina, Denmark, Finland, Germany, Israel, Italy, and the UK. So that's just a number of countries that know that it's so cruel that they just want to ban it outright. Some of these countries have done this through, a legislative act where they've enacted a law banning it. Others have interpreted the existing anti-cruelty statute in the country as banning foie gras because it's a generally cruel production. So Israel is probably the best example of that. In 2003, the Supreme Court of Israel actually ruled that that foie gras production was so cruel that it went against the general anti-cruelty statute in the country. And this was sort of notable because at the time, Israel was the fourth largest producer of foie gras around the world. So even though they had a substantial industry in the country already, the Supreme Court decided that, it was so clearly a cruel practice that it couldn't go on given that the country had an anti-cruelty statute on the books.
I want to talk about that more and how it relates to the United States. Now, I know the United States has a law called the Poultry Products Inspection Act, which prohibits diseased poultry. However, obviously, it's still being produced and sold in the U.S., but Compassion Over Killing, along with other organizations, have filed a lawsuit against the USDA for violating this law. Can you please tell us about that and how it is that the USDA allows itself to violate its own law that is supposed to protect American citizens?
Sure. I'll try to make this as simple as possible. It's kind of a complicated case. So the Poultry Products Inspection Act condemns what it calls adulterated poultry products. So these are unhealthy or unsound or diseased products. And as I explained, we think, these ducks are definitely sick with hepatic lipidosis. And so it seems clear that under this law, they should be condemned because they are a diseased, unhealthy animal producing diseased, unhealthy products in their liver. What happens is the USDA is the federal agency in the U.S. that implements this law. They have to put out regulations following this law that Congress has passed. But the USDA actually inspects and allows the sale of foie gras despite this mandate by the federal government. So what happened was COK petitioned the USDA, the agency that actually does these inspections, and asked them to implement a new regulation that classified foie gras as a kind of diseased animal product under the PPIA, and therefore to make it illegal going forward to sell it for consumption. The USDA denied that petition, and in the U.S., there's a way in which if an agency denies a petition request for rulemaking, or what's called rulemaking, you can sue them in court to have the court review that decision. So we took USDA to court because we think that they are interpreting the law incorrectly, and that it is a mandatory duty for them to condemn these products to protect public health. The first court, the district court level, dismissed our case, and he said that's because what we were asking for was to have an already existing law enforced, and that meant that the court couldn't review what USDA's denial. So we're currently appealing that in the Ninth Circuit, Interestingly, our appeal is in the same court that has, up until recently, upheld the foie gras ban in California. So we feel confident that the Ninth Circuit really understands how the law should work and that animals should be protected, and that they'll find that the district court was wrong in their decision.
And what do you know what a timeline might be for that? Because I know it's been some, I think it's been some time now that you've been waiting for this appeal to go through.
Yeah, so we've done all our briefing, so we're just waiting for the court to schedule what's called oral arguments. So this is our chance and the government's chance to get up and actually make arguments in front of the judge. The courts in the U.S. can be very backlog and slow, so we're hoping it will happen soon, but we're at somewhat mercy of the court's schedule right now.
So in 2004, in the state of California, there was a victory won to institute a ban on the sale of foie gras, which came into effect on July 1st, 2012. Can you tell us about this ban and the process that went into actualizing it?
Sure. So the ban in California, there are actually two parts to this law on foie gras. So the first part of the ban makes it illegal to force feed a bird for the purpose of enlarging its liver in the state. So this effectively bans foie gras production in California. At the time this law went into effect, there was one producer in California who has since shut down. And so now that ban is in place, it went into effect in July 1st of 2012, there is no production of foie gras in California. Secondly, the California state legislature passed a ban on the sale of foie gras in the state. So this meant if you were a restaurant and you were serving foie gras on your menu, it was then, as of July 1st, 2012, illegal to even sell that product, even if you got it from out of state. In terms of how the ban came about, lots of the laws in California about farm animals have been enacted through what's called a ballot initiative. This is where voters can vote directly on the law. The foie gras ban actually went through the legislature, so it was just a matter of animal activists and animal advocacy groups convincing the state legislature that this was an important thing to do, that the state should be protecting animal welfare. And this is something that went through and was signed by Governor Schwarzenegger.
So as of earlier this month, the federal court struck down the law that prohibited the sale of foie gras in California, and it's being sold again in that state. Can you tell us how was the ban overturned and what kinds of politics were involved in the whole process of overturning the ban?
Sure. So this is sort of a long, convoluted story. From the day that the ban went into effect, foie gras producers and their association lobby groups had been suing the state of California to try to repeal this law. They're very unhappy about it. And so what they did first was they sued in California, and they made the argument that the ban violated the federal U.S. Constitution. And they asked the court to impose what's called an injunction, an immediate shutdown of the enforcement of the law. And the district court denied that, and then it went up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit denied that as well. And both courts found that basically the foie gras producers hadn't convinced them enough that it was likely that the ban violated the Constitution, so they weren't going to impose an immediate shutdown of the law. The foie gras producers tried to appeal that to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court denied the opportunity to review that decision. So because they were only asking because the first thing we're asking was just to shut down the law immediately, the case went back to the lowest level court to actually look closely at the merits of the case, the idea that the ban violates some kind of the constitutional challenge. What happened when it went back to the lower court level is that the foie gras producers added another claim to their lawsuit. They said that not only did it violate the federal constitution, but that a federal law, the PPIA, that law that I was talking about before, the Poultry Products Inspection Act, the federal law that regulates poultry, actually should override the California state law, because there's a doctrine in U.S. law that says federal laws override state laws on the same issue. And that's actually the argument that the district court most recently agreed with and struck down the law. It's sort of a tortured logic, if you would have it, as to why the district court agreed with the foie gras producers. Basically, what that Poultry Products Inspection Act says is that only the federal government and not the state government can impose an ingredient requirement on poultry. And so the district court bought the foie gras producer's argument that by banning force feeding, you are imposing an ingredient requirement on a poultry product, foie gras. We think that this is a very strange reading of the law and that in no way is regulating how you feed an animal could be considered an ingredient requirement in any way. And so we're hoping that the state of California will appeal this ruling up to the Ninth Circuit again. Only the state of California can do the appeal. None of us can bring that appeal ourselves. And so there's a movement to try to encourage the Attorney General of California to bring that appeal.
Well, thanks for all that info. That's really interesting, and it really explains it a lot better for us, I think. Now, I don't know if you saw, but a couple days ago, Bruce Friedrich from Farm Sanctuary wrote an excellent op-ed in the LA Times about this whole foie gras scandal, you could call it, or issue that's in the news lately. And he brought up a couple of interesting arguments that people apparently have against banning foie gras. And I want to know what you have to say about these. First of all, he says that some people are saying that force feeding does not necessarily involve egregious cruelty to animals, and animal activists are picking on foie gras because it's a luxury food. What do you have to say to that?
So I think this is such an interesting argument. This is a similar, sort of the same argument is animals suffer in factory farms much more than on foie gras farms, so why don't we go after the factory farm issue instead? I have two answers to this question. I mean, the first is that, you know, just because there are other animals suffering doesn't mean that we should try to protect all of them in any way that we can. So if we've already convinced the California legislature or other countries have been convinced for their entire country's law that this is an egregious, cruel practice that should be banned, then it seems to me that, you know, we should take any steps that we can to protect any animal that's suffering. And even if this is just a small percentage of animals creating a small delicacy food, that doesn't mean they don't deserve protections too. And you know, it may be easier to protect these animals, and so much the better if we can do that. It's just a small stepping stone into enacting protections for all animals that go into our food system. We've seen chefs talk about how, you know, well, I'm going to serve foie gras because, you know, the animal activists aren't really going after the big problems. They're only going after the small problems and targeting a small issue. I mean, I just think that's ridiculous. And in fact, none of the groups working on foie gras issues are looking at that exclusively. We are all trying to help animals throughout the entire food system, and it's just that we've had better success so far on this issue than on the other issues.
Thank you, Liz. That's an excellent answer. Finally, what can animal advocates do to help in fighting against the production of and the sale of foie gras in California or in other states or countries? What would you suggest?
So the first and most obvious thing is don't buy or eat foie gras. That's the best thing that anyone can do. If there is no demand for the product, then no one will sell it. Producers want to sell you what you will buy. And so if you won't buy it, then they won't make it. The second best thing you can do is educate your friends and family who might not know about where these products come from. I think most people, once they know how these products are produced, are amply horrified and therefore act to never buy or support these products again. If you go to a restaurant that you really like, but they serve foie gras, request, talk to the manager, see if they can take it off the menu. Say that you want to support that restaurant, but you're not going to support it as long as they serve foie gras. And, of course, sort of standard activism. Tell your legislatures that you want to support the ban or that you want to enact a ban if there isn't one in your area. And of course, you can always join the mailing list and keep up to date with all the animal activist groups like COK that are working on these issues. We send out action alerts if there's anything our members can do, and we try to keep everyone in the loop and give you concrete ideas about ways that you can help animals.
Thank you so much, Liz, for coming on the show today to speak about the cruelties of foie gras and how COK has been instrumental in fighting the USDA against it. To find out more about compassion over killing, please visit COK.net. Thanks again, Liz, and have a good day.
Thanks so much.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio on unceded Coast Salish territories. So please join us next for our next show, which is on Friday, February 6th. It'll be a surprise, so tune in to
love
see.
Surprises. Surprises. I'll be fun. There. Will you?
I might be there.
And you'll be here.
That was rhetorical. We here at Animal Voices want you to stay connected with us online. Animalvoices.org is where you can find, where you can stream our shows from our archive or download us as our podcasts. You can read our show blogs with detailed links and subscribe via iTunes. You can also learn about upcoming events like the event we were talking about Valentine's Day earlier in the show. So stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. So there's lots of ways to get a hold of us, so please make a connection. We'd love to hear from you. So we're closing the show with a song by Cassia called Full Wolf Song in honor of the British Columbian Wolves. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And please remember to be kind to the animals.